Oh, the shape that will get. If you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. You can get all our podcasts as well on offtheball.com and also on newstalk.com. Here this week, anyway, before we actually tell you what the interview is this week, or at least if you're on Twitter, you'll know already, but Joe Coffey.
Raf.
Fresh from Mayo, bouncing back.
Oh, Raf, what a result.
Yeah. Jonathan Higgins.
Fresh after a Galway double at the weekend.
Good. Cara Finn as well, I
absolutely,
presume you're,
yeah.
You're
yeah,
referring
next,
to.
Next
and Conor Neville of Longford fame.
Just fresh. Just fresh.
Yeah, Leitrim's five-game winning run came to an end at the weekend as well. But
hard work is done, Raf.
Yeah, no, we're playing Derry again in the Division 4 final. Somebody was saying to me that generally when the two finalists meet during the league, the team that loses during the league phase tends to win the final. So that's how the saying goes, anyway, Raf. Yeah, that's how the saying goes, and that's how it's going to happen when I actually turn up at Croke Park. But anyway, the interview this week, Jonathan was here on Friday. We spoke to Stig Inge Bjørneby. I hope I've pronounced that as well as I can. He's now Rosenborg's sporting director, but of course most of us here would probably know him as former Liverpool defender, so we'll play that out at the end tonight. But in the WhatsApp group there was a decision made to talk about stadium naming rights, as Joe Coffey smiles there. This is your idea, so this is obviously off the back of I am washing my hands.
Well, geez, I hope you're going to like contribute.
I will. No, so this is off
this
the back
is also
of
news to me, you know.
What are we talking
what
about?
What are we doing here?
Yeah, no, this piece is coming off the back of White Hart Lane, basically the tube station White Hart Lane is to be no more. It's being renamed as Tottenham Hotspur Station once the stadium opens, hopefully next month. And it's just so that will effectively mean that there will be no reference to White Hart Lane, other than because the stadium will be it's Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
That's the working title for now.
I wouldn't
be surprised. I think there's rumour that it might become, say, the Nike Stadium or something along those lines, but we don't know. We don't know yet. There's been no announcement.
Yeah. So that, I mean, to be honest, it's the rumours are that it'll be renamed the Nike Stadium, but you know, that's only a rumour. I think it's only a matter of time anyway before it's renamed and it becomes the equivalent of Arsenal's Emirates Stadium. But with the railway station being renamed to Tottenham Hotspur, and your new stadium being called either Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, because the fact that they're calling it Tottenham Hotspur Stadium would suggest they're just waiting for a sponsor to come in so that they can name it. Because otherwise,
this is a placeholder name.
It's a placeholder name because otherwise they'd either call it New White Hart Lane or they just call it White Hart Lane.
Yeah,
you know, they wouldn't bother with the change, and it's just. I mean, it's just a continuation of a process that began in the early 90s. I mean, the fact that basically almost every club of the 92 league clubs in England has updated their, and Wales, to be accurate, has updated their home grounds since 92. It just lends itself to the fact that these days the task of updating for most clubs tend to not update their stadium stand by stand. A lot of the bigger ones in particular try and just do the whole thing out new.
Yeah.
And financing a stadium is incredibly expensive. So the reality is that most of them go the way of their counter of NFL clubs and you're stuck with sponsorship names. And I think, to be honest, the only reason more clubs haven't done it yet, well, like the likes of Manchester United and Liverpool haven't done it, is because there's probably not as much need because they've succeeded in updating their stadiums stand by stand.
There's an incredible weight of tradition behind their grounds as well.
I don't think, speaking as a Liverpool fan here, I wouldn't be happy with a sponsorship. It'll always be Anfield to me. This is Anfield. What are you going to do? Change the sign then as well? I think FSG kind of dropped little murmurs of the, you know, like the political parties do before the budget and stuff like this, drop little snippets out to see what sort of reaction it got back a couple of years ago when it was well and truly cut down. So I think it's one of the few clubs where you will see, like, you look around Man City, you know, Chelsea were probably going to do something before their owner went a bit belly up. And Daniel Levy isn't going to miss a trick here. He will try and milk every bit of money.
How lucrative do they tend to be, these naming rights?
So they've gone up 80%, and that's why I have my phone beside my hand, beside the microphone, and just staring into it and not seemingly
engaging
the conversation.
Sounds like I teed up that question.
You did. I was going to jump in earlier, but no, they've gone up 80%, and say Manchester United's value, now this is going back to 2018, it is now, according to this newspaper article, an outrageous, that's not my word, £26.2 million. So, again, that doesn't seem, it's big, but it's
like
not
half a good player.
Yeah, in the current climate, It would have been one good player back in, what are we,
late noughties?
Yeah, late noughties. Around the time they brought, say, a Varane for whatever, 28 million or whatever it was, or Rooney for 30,
Since you asked and I was able to successfully Google it there quickly, Emirates and Arsenal agreed a deal of £150 million sterling in November 2012.
That was groundbreaking at the time wasn't it?
Yeah, and naming rights, the shirt sponsorship was updated in 2018, and the naming rights are to last now until 2028. In which case, they'll either be continued or a new sponsor will be found.
Was there much anger among Arsenal fans when it was changed? I don't remember. I mean, it came with a new stadium, of course, which softened it a bit.
Yeah, not really.
Highbury was going anyway.
There was fairly rapid Arsenal change in a period of about 10 years where Arsenal dropped their crest for a more corporate-friendly crest that they could trademark. I mean, that was the reason why they changed the crest in the first place.
Why, the old gun?
The old Victoria.
Not very politically correct.
The Latin motto underneath. What was it? Victory through harmony or something like that?
Okay.
But they...
Sounds quite right-wing, the old Arsenal. harmony through victory, surely.
Harmony through victory.
It was probably Ronald Reagan's peace through strength.
You couldn't trademark the crest. The crest was quite complicated, and you couldn't, you know, if you looked at the design.
Yeah, it was a bit, there was a lot going on.
It was a very, that Victorian, real complex style to it. Because it was so, I'm not completely sure behind, I'd have to look into this, but the reason, I think pretty sure they couldn't trademark it because it was so old.
Okay.
And it was just that everyone in the community could claim rights to it because it had always been that way. And, you know, if you're going back to the 50s and 60s, you're like, well, look. But that, I mean, the crest got more complex as it went on. I mean, most people that into football will have probably seen that Charlie George goal in the 71 final. And for that, like, it's literally just a cannon and that's it.
In the shape of one.
In the shape of a cannon and there's nothing else. It's only in the years following that it grew more complex. The new corporate friendly one, a bit like, you know, I suppose Juventus, it's a bit like that where it's just Juventus is just a J.
It's a social media platform.
There was a big uproar about the crest or logo when it was initially unveiled, and then you just get used to it, and now it's the Arsenal logo. And I remember reading somewhere that they actually changed the cannon around to face towards the rumor has it to face towards Tottenham. I don't know if that's true.
That seems too close.
Because the cannon is facing a different way.
Because even actually Chelsea's badge from what it was in the 1990s has completely changed to whatever it is now. It still has a kind of lion motif, but it was again a lot more going on back in the era.
Spurs are at an advantage in that their logo will never have to change because it's so simple. If you were designing a logo now, you'd actually say that Spurs have one of the most perfect logos for today's modern world. So simple.
The Chelsea one is, it used to be a kind of a lion leaning on a C's and F's and...
Chelsea reverted. They went from one logo to...
Chelsea strike me as they're easily able to change anyway, you know. They're not welded to their old traditions, you know.
Chelsea,
they've become a new thing.
They are a new club since Abramovich. I mean, it's not the same.
Chelsea were interesting in that they went from their traditional logo that they came up with in the fifth, well, their more traditional logo that began in the 50s was replaced by the lion leaning on CFC up until 05, and then they actually went back to the traditional logo.
Oh,
again,
I see.
But modernised it.
Oh, well, I apologise to Chelsea. They clearly care deeply about their long-held traditions. Here was me thinking they were all brand spanking new.
It's changed a little bit over the years that primarily Live Roberts is stays there. And there's been a bit added for the Hillsborough Flames has been added. But by and large, it hasn't changed that much over the years, no.
Even Manchester United's has a little bit, but you're having to go back, I think, to like bygone eras, the 70s or 60s, that kind of period. But for the most part, like since the rebranding of the club, and obviously they're the biggest, probably the biggest football brand there is, it hasn't really changed, not in my lifetime anyway.
No,
which of course, it's not a long time.
The work that they've done through the 90s, I beg your pardon, they just went steps ahead of the rest of the Premier League, really. In terms of, and a lot of clubs in Liverpool in particular are the one that are trying to play catch up, as are a lot of the other clubs.
We've often mentioned it, but say Paris Saint-Germain are probably and Juventus are the two that most spring to mind when we're talking about logo changes. And Paris Saint-Germain definitely went down a more simplified road, particularly the fact that they, you know, are shouting the Paris part right in your face now. And Saint-Germain is quite small, whereas in the old crest, the Paris Saint-Germain was one word at the top. It's interesting, like what they're trying, like because they're big on this whole rebrand of we want to be basically called Paris.
Yeah, because there's no other club in the city.
Yeah.
Well, there are other clubs, obviously, but they're not playing at the top in the top flight. So I think they want to kind of make sure they claim basically every fan base there, because it's a huge football fan base, and probably before this PSG rebrand and the Qatar ownership came in, they never really made the most of even the players that they pick up from the area. They always go off and end up playing like the likes of Pogba, Kante, all born in the wider region but never really got picked up. Yeah, the PSG one is interesting.
Of course, the PSG one's interesting. Another one that we haven't mentioned is our own FAI. I mean,
are
like,
they in the news?
Oh, well, no. I mean, like, go on.
Is that the article I read the other day?
I think Off the Ball are probably covering that already, so we don't need to go back over it again.
No,
but the FAI, you know, they had the traditional shamrock, and then they kind of went into this one that they have now, which is basically Ireland and a football and a load of squiggles. It doesn't really mean anything. And actually, out of all the crests you can have for national teams in Ireland, you know, like the rugby one or the, who else? Jeez.
Cricket.
Hockey. Yeah.
But like, it would appear that it is the least inspiring.
Oh.
I would think. My opinion. That's just my opinion.
It's another indictment on the new regime, is it? Were you a fan of the early 90s one where they had the bit of orange in the corner, wasn't it?
I just think they should go back to the shamrock. Or even the harp. I mean, what does Ireland in a football mean, really?
What was the shamrock? This is like
Ireland
your
football team.
You're going back to when Dunphy was playing, or Gilesy.
Yeah.
The
Irish football crest has absolutely nothing to do with the country. I mean, nothing to do with our traditions or anything like that. It is literally like England have the three.
I can't actually picture it.
Well, there it is in all its glory. Now
this
sorry
is great radio.
Yeah,
now.
I know.
This
apologies, listeners, radio. But if you need descriptions, I think it's, you can all. Imagine.
All right, it's just a football.
It's
with
an outline of a football, like
with squirrels.
Like it could be mistaken for a lot of squirrels.
It doesn't really mean an awful lot, and if you look at the, you know, there's the classic one. There
oh, that's
from
the Euro. Joe was showing us Euro 88. Yeah, the shamrock with the kind of
a lot of shamrocks.
Orange border and shamrocks.
I just think it's probably stood for a bit more, you know.
Is there a Genesis report into how this new logo came to be?
There was more than likely an extensive marketing.
Absolutely.
There's always marketing
company taken
these
on
things.
Board who sat down with the FAI, went through their values, their ethos, what they stand for. They would have given them several options, and that's what they went with.
The football.
Well, like, you know, there are definitely meanings behind all the squirrels on it. But I just think
it's flying through the air. Towards Niall Quinn's head and the hope of a flick on.
But like, I just think that, I mean, like, you look say it's the English one, it's three lines on a shirt. And like, they've built a whole. Oh, yeah. They have built a whole cultural phenomenon around that. Three lines on, and a even
well, Frank Skinner had a lot to do with that.
He probably did, yeah.
But like even the fact
and
now
the Lightning
that,
Seeds and David Baddiel,
they all helped. But even the fact now that if you want to cross references to the social media generation now, you see even Declan Rice or whatever when he's tweeting first time, he's able to put the three lines emoji, and it just. It's probably not sure if it was intended, but it's turned out to be marketing goal, the fact that they're able to have, like, what's an Irish person going to do, player going to do? A load of shamrocks, which isn't even our crest anymore.
No, and like, that's why, like, I mean.
Is that why Declan Rice made the decision?
I wouldn't expect that's high up
I suspect
there,
that was actually kind of
it's
the
like, I was looking at, he tweeted today, if you want a little bit of a giggle, look at some of the replies under his tweets.
Have you not unfollowed all of his social media accounts?
No, it's still there. It's still there.
Okay. I would argue that having the actual national flag as your crest, like say Italy do, would be far more effective than a football with squiggles.
How high up the list of priorities in the FAI do you think this should be?
In this current climate?
In this current climate.
Given that everything else
Before the last week, I think it was near the top of the agenda. Maybe a couple of things have...
Given that we've ironed out almost every other kink.
Anyway,
tune into Off the Ball for more detailed analysis.
And we've changed the name of our stadium as well.
Ah, yes, that's...
I still call it Lansdowne Road, I have to say.
That is a brilliant segue.
What do you call it?
Oh, well, I call it the Aviva now.
And you?
Lansdowne Road.
You?
I try and say Lansdowne Road, unless I'm obliged, by...
But there is
some sort of media relationship with the FAI.
It's fascinating, the battle that goes on, though, and you see this repeated in media across the world, where if they're having an argument with, say, an association, they might go down the road of, well, we're not going to call it... the sponsored name stadium, we're going to call it the Originals.
I think UEFA do that, don't they? That's the
UEFA do that.
Yeah, but their official. But I know
every time there's a European game at the Aviva, it's
at the
called
Dublin
Stadium,
Dublin Arena,
or something like that. Yeah, there's a name on it.
But it happens when there's disputes going on as well, particularly like if say local press or might be unhappy with it. If you look at English football, if local press are unhappy with say the management team or the chairman or something like that, they'll just refuse to call the stadium its sponsored name and revert back to the old name. You know,
the one that got me the most in terms of a stadium name was it's now derelict, and I don't want to lead on to the other conversation that goes, but West Ham's old ground, Upton Park.
Yes,
all of a sudden this came the bowling lane, like towards the end. I never heard of it
the bowling ground. Yeah,
up until about 6 months prior to the
departure. Yeah, well, I'd always heard. Back the years when you were learning the names of grounds when you were a kid, that the Upton Park, I was told, used to be the bowling ground. And it became Upton Park at some point later on. So the bowling ground is actually a reversion to an older name.
Now they have the free taxpayers account, or what do they call it? What do they call
it? I think, I know you can talk about tradition with the likes of United and Liverpool, but I actually think if United and Liverpool went down the road of building a new ground, that's where you'd see the naming rights come in.
It's easier to do it there, obviously.
To do it when you build a new stadium. Much more difficult to do it when you're adding on a few thousand seats, or even building a new stand. Much more difficult when you're just building a stand and saying, right, we're going to call the stadium something else. I think it's trickier. But something is definitely being lost all the same.
Yeah, well, you look at Liverpool and... Again, I'm biased, but like in terms of heritage and stuff like that, it's held. And it's one of the good things that FSG have done when they extended the main stand is that they kept a lot of the inner vibes, the way the stadium is designed. You know, there's still a very good view. Even if you're up the top of the main stand, it's kept in a way that you still have a good view of the pitch.
Yeah.
It's built to hold in all the noise. The acoustics are built quite well. They've gone out of their way to keep it, you know, although it's a modern new add on to the old part of the stadium, it blends in quite well, and it's one of the things they've done very, very well, where it could have been so easy just to throw a slab up on the side of the ground and really take the soul out of it.
Have they altered Fenway Park much? Like, is there a similar...
I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't be the strongest in my
baseball. Neither would I, but Fenway Park is
a similar kind of history
to Anfield.
If only
we
had someone over the other side of the table that had a laptop on Mr. Google.
It's all right, Joe. I don't need to know that bad.
Sure, I can Google it now. This is a great addition to the show where I just
I'm not sure if it's working for the listeners, but there you go.
But I think that something is being lost in this quest to amass as much money as possible. And this is the Premier League is pretty much, I think we all agree, is solely about how much money can each entity make in as quick a time as possible. It's the march continues towards, all you have to do is look at the NFL and you go, that is where the Premier League is going. This whole thing of sponsorship deals and naming rights and all that, I mean, obviously that's all been in place over there for quite some time. And I think the reality is that the Premier League is obviously probably Britain's greatest export, and or the England's greatest export.
It will be when Brexit actually happens, anyway.
And like,
if it happens,
I mean, it's often been talked about, these clubs are not about the community as much anymore. There's a few exceptions where, like, the likes of Liverpool and Everton.
Are very good, to be fair. Yeah. Well.
Liverpool and Everton dominate the city.
And Man City, to be fair, as well. And United. Despite the whole new soulless image of the club prior to the takeovers and all that, they do an incredible amount of local community work and local charity work as well. But to be fair.
But it's becoming more difficult for the communities to keep hold of these clubs. I know Newcastle tried to go down the Sports Direct Arena road for a while, and that was heavily resisted. And eventually, I think the naming rights were sold, and the company that bought the naming rights just decided, let's just call it St. James's Park.
An easy solution.
And that's another way to do it. I mean, you can buy the naming rights to these things.
Well, what did that company getting out of it?
Maybe the feel good factor from the local feel good factor from the city, probably, and also I'm sure their name is
hoardings and brandings everywhere, yeah.
Concours and all that.
Maybe you could go down that road. I know our own GA stadium in Castlebar is called Elvery's McKell Park, so maybe that's the road. Maybe it should be. You could go
just
down.
Put a prefix there that you can just cut away, is it? Keep it running.
Although it's interesting that the broadcasters are dear to it. I'm not so sure.
I'm not quite sure of the locals. Yeah. Where are you heading down tonight?
Yeah, the fact I wasn't aware of that, probably more work needs to be done. One of the things actually you put in the group actually was the whole miking up of referees. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, so it was an experiment done in the Australian MLS. Where they literally just mic'd up a referee for the day, and everybody got to hear, similar to what we have in rugby. Quite a unique experience. It's definitely, everyone talks about one of the bad things about football in England is the abuse given to referees and how it's not a good example to kids, etc. Here's a perfect way when players are going to be, knowing that they're going to be mic'd up, knowing that they're going to be picked up on television. I'm sure they're going to, we've seen in rugby where they've toned down their F's and Q's quite a lot, and I think it would only be a good development, if only for the fact as well, as the referees now know that they can't go blind. They can't, because the referees, particularly in England, are in a bubble at the moment. They can go out, they can make pretty much as many mistakes as they want, and they're not questioned afterwards. They can't get questioned by the press afterwards. They don't have to explain themselves. So the fact that they know that they're mic'd up, I think would have a little bit more on their conscience. I think it would lead to a lot more, because we saw there was a Liverpool draw with Tottenham at Anfield last season, a finish 2. John Moss was the referee in the day, and he had an absolute mare. Like, some of the decisions he gave, and he opened up himself to a lot of criticism, because he was having a discussion with the linesman over by the in front of the stand where Sky had a camera at the time, and they picked up him like saying something like, oh, is there any chance of seeing that on television? It opened a can of worms. But I think if referees know that they're, both referees and players and managers as well, to a certain extent, we've seen the level of abuse that they can give, if it clean up that aspect to it. And I think it would be a unique experience for the fans as well. I'm not sure if we're going to go down the level where everyone has their earpiece like we have in rugby, or your FM transmitter out to it. But I think I'd be very open to at least trial it in a couple of the preseason friendlies or something like that.
It's not unique.
No, it's not. There was a fascinating article written on this that I found online, written by in 2016 by a lad called Connor Neville.
Oh really? It's so good that he can't even remember it.
Still got me blank.
It was a brilliant piece.
Joe, you have me panicked.
Just say it was good.
There is a precedent for it, which is David Ellery.
The article is about this.
Well, I can't claim to be breaking any news there 26 years later, but David Ellery was mic'd up. It wasn't for the whole 90 minutes. I think, well, it was for the whole 90 minutes, but it was for a television program that shortened it into
World in Action.
Was it World in Action? Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Joe. it was the last year Millwall were in the top flight.
It was Arsenal versus Millwall.
Millwall at home to Arsenal. I think Arsenal would have been champions, in fact. I think it might have been late 1989, I suspect. And Ellery was mic'd up. Although the difference here is, and what Jonathan's talking about, is that the players were not told that Ellery was being mic'd up.
Millwall
were told.
Oh, okay.
So both clubs were told.
Right. You remember what I've written better than I do.
Well, it's easy when I can read it in front of me.
Right, but
both clubs were told, except Arsenal never told the players.
George Graham didn't. George Graham came into the referees' room afterwards,
and there was a camera crew in there,
presumably to have stern words with Mr. Ellery, because you know his players were getting upset with him anyway. And then Graham saw the camera crew and then reared back from the door in a very chastened fashion. But yeah, the players were. I think Tony Adams might have called Ellery a cheat or something.
So the infamous moment from this show was a decision going against Adams, and Adams running by Ellery and going, "You effing cheat," and then Ellery pulling him back and giving him a yellow card. And like, because Arsenal were acting like they would have done during any game, and to be honest, any team would have done during the game.
No, it's just Arsenal at that time.
I think if you went down the road of miking up referees, eventually referees would gain more control over the game, over how the game is perceived.
They would definitely get a lot more respect. Connor, you kind of brought it into my head there. It was a flashback just when we're on the point of how it potentially would or would not clean up the game. There was a documentary done, I think it was McGoldrick, one of the Regia referees.
All-Ireland final. They did it for the hurling final in 2017 and the football final, the one you were talking about, in 2015.
Yeah, and I just remember like a lot of...
Goldrick, wasn't it? David Goldrick.
Yeah, that was right. And
I think it was the whole... Was it just about the referee or was it about the whole All-Ireland final?
It was about the day itself, but the newsworthy bits were the ref.
Yeah.
I think the newsworthy bit was Kieran Donaghy.
Yeah.
Claiming he was gouged.
Yeah.
There was some disquiet.
There was a lot of kind of reaction for the players, because a lot of the players realised for the first time they were mic'd up and it was going to be on public broadcast was when it was aired. And then the next morning, I think the GPA in particular were...
They weren't
were
happy.
But it just goes to show like that when players, no matter what the level of what the sport is, once they're exposed, at the end of the day, they are, whether they're paid or professional players, they are kind of PR machines.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be seen in a bad light. Mm. And I think that's it. That's if nothing else, that's one reason why they potentially might clean themselves up from a verbal point of view. It can only be a help to the referees as well. And as much as we bane referees as time, if you know you're going to be kind of seen on camera or heard on camera, you are going to be a bit more careful. And you can question sometimes, and I'd be more vocal than anybody about the standard of quality of the referees and some of the decisions that they may make. But I think if the pressure was taken off a little, it may help and definitely will clean.
Do you think the mics have had an effect that are responsible for rugby players being uber respectful of the referees? I thought that was the rugby propagandists would tell you that's intrinsic to the game,
because they come out of the womb wrapped in a cotton blanket.
I do think the refs been mic'd up has really helped rugby.
Of course it has.
Has it though? Well, we don't know what it was like before.
No, of course we don't.
But it's created an aura that you have to respect. And
I mean,
kids then growing up,
they're all aware of it though.
They have the thing of only the captain goes up to speak to the referee.
I thought it was rugby people respect the rules. Was that not it, Joe?
We probably need a rugby person on here.
I think there's been enough high profile cases of rugby clubs and rugby clubs / countries breaking rules in major games for us to go.
These rugby lads, they're English rugby lads are at the top of the social tree. They look at the rules and they say, well, whatever the rules are, they've served me well. They've served me well, so I'm going to obey them even if they go against me this time. Whereas GA people like you, Joe, come from a culture where the rules haven't done them any good. They haven't done Irish people any good, so authority is to be questioned.
Rules are there to be broken.
If I can get on the pitch, I will.
This is my anthropological theory of why GA refs are treated like dirt compared to rugby refs. And soccer refs even worse.
Well, actually, I think GA refs are treated deplorably.
I think particularly in the club scene.
Who'd be a referee? And you know, sometimes in my younger days of going to games, I would actually, when you would get the rage and you'd shout at the referee, but as I've gotten older, I've grown wiser, and you go, you know what, like, how, if I'm sitting here and I think what I see, how can I be, like, if I'm not sure what I can see, how can I be criticising the referee?
I remember just an example.
And also, sorry to cut across here, but if we keep going down the road of particularly in GA, going after the referee, we won't have referees.
You hear so many examples then of, there's only a few back home as well, where referees are get chased afterwards, get locked into dressing rooms afterwards, get followed into their cars afterwards. But just
Wicklow, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, the Battle of Arum, isn't it?
There's enough examples back home in the West as well without spelling out people.
Mayo people love moaning about referees doing them out of high profile.
That's the only reason they haven't won an Ireland.
But I tell you, out of them all, the only game where I could go, yeah, the referee probably influenced the game heavily, was the 96, and I know we've gone off on a mad tangent here, but the 96 replay against Meath, Mayo had so many chances to win that game and still didn't.
Chances the first day, never mind the replay.
Yeah. Like, you know, the game against Kerry, you could argue, yeah, he probably had a fair massive influence by the fact that, like, he gave a load of handy frees to Kieran Donaghy in the dying minutes of the game, you know. So anyway,
how do football absolutists who listen to this cope with you going off on long tangents about Mayo?
Okay, so
Mayo ghost of all Ireland past.
That's a show.
That's more than a show. That's an entire Netflix series.
I'll wheel it back into the point then, and it's one example that I can give from a personal point of view.
They've had 5 years of it. They're used to it now.
We'll never get it. We'll always be thinking of what could have been.
So this example, I feel like, just ties the whole thing together, and it's just from a personal point of view. It's my aunt from the US was over, this is about 10 years ago, and I was playing football back home, and I brought her to one of my games. It was literally a pre-season friendly, the back Arsenal place, on a back pitch at the back of a school or something like that, and like there was only a handful of people at it, and she couldn't get over the level of abuse towards the referee.
Yeah.
And it was a day where there was on the standard of things that you'd say, there was literally peekaboo set.
Yeah.
And just couldn't get over it. And this is a person that would have, like, would her extended family would have been to loads of football games, basketball games, baseball games, all in the American sporting scene. Wasn't a sports person or been to many sports events, could not get over. And this was, as I said, a preseason friendly with a man and a dog pretty much at it. And that shows the level, I think, where we are at the moment. If there's anything that can be done to help that, I think the small thing of micing the roofs, and if only just for the entertainment value.
Yeah.
I vividly remember covering a Mayo club soccer game in the Super League or something back in the day, and I won't name the clubs involved, but anyway, it doesn't really matter anyway. But there was two clubs playing, and there was a load of 50-50 balls, and I didn't really care. Well, obviously I didn't care who won. But I remember halfway through the game, one of the managers turned around going, "You see this injustice going on here, you should write about it." And I'm kind of going, "Christ almighty, where are we going? Like, if managers are feeling victimized, like, at the end of the day, no referee, you spend so much time preparing and training and getting fit and doing all this stuff and going covering soccer matches where you're getting paid feck all, you're getting paid your mileage or whatever, you know, you get paid feck all in Ireland particularly, I'm not talking about professional referees in the Premier League, but there's no glory in it. Why the hell would you be going in making decisions for one, deciding I hate this club, I'm going to make loads of decisions for the other club? You don't do that. Like, you make mistakes, but you don't go out to do over a team.
Yeah,
it's something, sorry, something that I've noticed the further I've gone, because I used to be like, I'm not going to say I was an angel and that I'd give my fair share of abuse to referees. I'd be one of these people that I'd be calm and composed off the pitch, but once across the line, it's like your release or whatever. And sometimes, and I'm no doubt I have gone over the top, I've refereed a couple of games and I've seen that point of view. But one of the biggest kind of seeing it from the other end of the spectrum was when I started, you know, working in media and stuff like that and covering games. And I'm talking even Premier League division games here as well on Friday nights, whatever, you get to see, and you're there sat in the stand, you know, a lot of the Irish stadiums are so small and compact that you're pretty much in with the home fans, and you're there going away and you're watching the game, and sometimes you think you're watching a completely different game to what all the supporters are. You see like a clear free kick and all of a sudden everyone's jumping up and down and you're like, what the hell? You're almost get to a stage, if you were a volatile character, if you are an argumentative type character, you'd almost be saying something like, what the hell are you on about? Mm-hmm. And even, you know, sometimes if the game is on RT or whatever, you have the player there and you can show them, Mac, look, you're a fool, like this is a blatant free, and they're like, oh yeah, and they'll still go on and give out about it. Like, it's just incredible, the mindset, really, isn't it? At times.
I think the extreme culture, the most extreme is probably Italy. I don't know, John Foote had a book out called Calcio, which is a very good book, and he talked about refs in one chapter, and he actually compared them to virtuous minorities in Italian football. I think he seemed to compare them to anti-mafia magistrates or something. So the honest refs who were berated by the rest of Italian society. He referred to a chairman of some Serie A club. I forget the name of the club, but they were kind of one of those clubs that sort of hovers around the lower half of this Syria a lot, you know. Yeah. I don't know where the yo-yo, but probably something in that vein. And this guy was an entrepreneur as well. He released some sort of board game, which essentially translated as whack the ref or something, which is like a kind of whack-a-mole style game where you attack.
That'd be popular back in Mayo now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, where you attack a ref.
Why do you think
he's selling in the wrong country?
Why do you think the culture in, and this is what, you know, the rugby culture when it comes to referees is so different from GAA/soccer? In this country in particular.
I've given you my top
again,
of the head.
Yeah, go on. Again.
That rugby was founded in elite schools, and these lads figure that, you know, whatever the rules are, they've served us well in life, and, you know, even if it goes against us this time, we're going to... We're going to abide by them. And, is my top of the head, probably entirely ignorant.
What about when they have the respect the kicker and everyone in the stadium is silent? And fair play to them. That's excellent.
This sounds like a bugbear, Joe.
What about when everyone in the pub is saying shh when somebody's talking while the kick has been taken?
Well, yeah, I mean that's obviously rugby pomposity, which we're all from. It's a scourge of Irish society and every other society.
I just think it's completely daft, but anyway.
Yeah, if you want to compare the flash, I don't know why it just came into my head.
Is it true that people shush in pubs now?
I don't know. There's a lot of urban myths about it, and I just like to latch on.
I'm sure it's happened. But
does
anybody
throw a GPS tracker at the referee or anything?
Well,
like?
I mean, that's a bit different. I mean, that happens on the
field. That's a board game now in Mayo that could be released.
Whack the kicker.
GPS.
Does that brought us to an end now, almost?
Do you remember when we did the piece with Ewan McKenna where we just bashed
it? It would have been a great piece with Ewan McGregor. No, I remember that piece with Ewan McKenna, yeah. No, it was, I think it was up to that point, our most listened to show. This is the Irish rugby. It was the day after, actually Connor, you were here as well. It was the day after Argentina, yeah.
We lost to Argentina in the World
Cup. And it felt like the perfect piece to do. So
I suppose you have him ready to go after the quarter final in the 2019 World Cup.
We'll make the call. Make the call. But I think that almost sums up.
As you'd say in GA circles, they may be peaking later in the year.
Stigging of Bjornaby, obviously played for Liverpool back in the 1990s up to the year 2000, went on to play for Blackburn, was part of Norway's golden generation. He was chatting to me and Jonathan about his career. He is now Rosenborg's sporting director. Some interesting bits here, including his involvement in the whole Dockers strike in 1995 when he went down to see what was going on. So that's in the middle of the interview, but here it is. Okay, we're delighted to be joined by Stig Inge Bjørneby, former Liverpool defender, also part of the Norway Golden Generation, and currently Rosenborg Sporting Director, and he's on the line with us now. I suppose, Stig, to start off, football was obviously the main sport that you've kind of gone into, and that's what your life has been built around, but your father was an Olympic skier. Was that ever kind of something you would have thought maybe you might have gone into?
Well, I actually did. As you grow up, as many other kids, you look up to your father, and he was obviously doing well in ski jumping, which is not a very common sport in in England and Ireland. But Yeah, as a kid, I was very eager to do the ski jumping. I did it every winter, all the way up till I was 15, and played football in the summer. So when I was 15, 16, I had better success playing football, so I had to make a choice, and obviously that was football.
Yeah, and it's funny enough because how life turns out, but so you've been a Liverpool supporter since the age of six, isn't it? And it was kind of through your father.
Again, I was doing that together with my father because I think from the 70s, the Norwegian TV broadcasters, they made some kind of deal with English TV production companies. So we had, since the 70s, a live game every afternoon on Saturday through the season at 4 o'clock Norwegian time. So we sat down, watched that game. It was a highlight of the week. And especially when Liverpool was on, because my father was a Liverpool fan, I became a Liverpool fan naturally. So that's that was really special, and it's still very emotional to think back, sitting there watching Liverpool together with my father.
Yeah, and of course, as you said, you played football at youth level, and then eventually it takes you to Rosenborg, who of course are, for us, in a foreign audience, we would look at them as Norway's biggest club. It's, you know, you're playing in the Norwegian Cup Final in 1992. Obviously, you don't know what's going to happen the very, very next day, but I was looking at the footage of a game against Lillestrøm. So this was the final of that Norwegian Cup. You score a shot from outside the box with your left foot. Can you just talk us through that goal and maybe your sense of feeling and whether you even realised there were people watching you ready to bring you to another country?
Well, you know, these I'm not very good at looking back on things like this because my memory is not that specific. I memorize the emotions and the feelings I had around the experience, but I'm not one for remembering every little detail from the games I've played in the past. But I do remember, obviously, it's a childhood dream to play in the cup final to start with, and obviously becoming the match winner in the 89th minute, I think it was. It was 2-2 at the time, and going towards extra time, but we scored that goal in the 89th minute, and obviously won the cup, and it's a big, very big occasion. It's like it's similar. It's similar to the FA Cup in England. It's a great tradition around the tournament, and the final is a big occasion. So it was very, very special.
Yeah, and the very next day, then you get a phone call from somebody you would have watched on TV. I presume, as everyone would probably know, Graeme Souness, who's often in Ireland, he rings you. And what's your emotion when somebody you've grown up watching is calling you and saying, "Look, we want you to come over and play for the club you supported since you were a little boy"?
Well, you have to. It's strange as well. I'm not much of a dreamer. I'm very realistic. I've always been very realistic. And at the time, I was at a level where a phone call like this from England wasn't necessarily too far away because we played at a decent level. I was 22 at the time, and after the game, I was in. Me and one other player, Kåre Ingebrigtsen, who ended up at Man City half a year later, we were invited up to the to a VIP lounge. We didn't know why. We didn't know who to meet. We got in the lounge, and there was Sir Alex Ferguson and Tom Saunders, who was the chief scout at Liverpool at the time. So we shook hands with them and said hi to them, and that was it, really. We just stood there, and what's next? And basically, we were told to, all right, that's okay, you can leave now. So I didn't really understand what was going on, but the next day, as you said, I had a phone call. I was invited over to stay with Liverpool for a couple of weeks. And it wasn't really a trial, because when I flew over, I met with Souness, and he told me that he'd made his decision. It was just up to me now to see if I liked it and train with him for a couple of weeks. And while they were checking out work permit, which was necessary at the time, and things like that. So, yeah, it was a good time, a good experience.
Ian Steg, in your time, your 8 years as a Liverpool player, I think when I look back and, you know, I speak as a Liverpool supporter and from speaking to Liverpool supporters, do some research for this piece, you were very much the definition of what I would call a cult hero. You could see the passion that you had for the club. You could pretty much tell that, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but that you'd supported Liverpool as a kid. It was very evident in your style of football. And, you know, a complete wand of a left foot that we'll speak about a bit more. But I just want to speak about it. I was just digging through and I found this quote. It's from a former teammate of yours, Paul Ince, and it probably hit the nail on the head in terms of, if I can just describe your time at Liverpool. Stig was an amazing player, maybe the best I played with, because he had that inner drive, the ability to motivate himself, the ability to work hard all the time. He was not the greatest talent, the most skillful player, but he had that something that many of us others lacked, the guts and attitude to do his job. That for me just felt like, you know, the perfect summary of your football career, but definitely your time at Liverpool. How does it feel when you see quotes like that from a former teammate?
Who was the quote from? Sorry?
It's from Paul Ince, your former teammate.
All right. That was very kind of him. Yeah, Paul was a good friend. We had obviously different backgrounds, and he was very established on a high level coming from Man United at the time. And I think we shared some good experiences in the gym and on the training field. And when we got to know each other, we came from kind of different angles and learned from each other. And these things put things into perspective to a certain degree, if you're allowed to think too much about those things, because I'm too humbled. I just feel lucky to play with players of that caliber, and there was a few more, of course. I always had the approach to the whole Liverpool experience that these players are so good. I have to do something special in other areas. If I can compete with them, if I can perform at the same level, I have to, or I can compete with them on all the different things that I could, like professionalism, preparations, restitution after games, and so on. So I'm sure these are the things that that he's pointing out and that he made a note of.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we spoke on an earlier, one of those things that you definitely was, when I look back on your career at Liverpool, was that absolutely wand of your left foot you had. There seemed to be a season there, I think it was the 96-97 season, yeah, where every cross that you took nearly landed on for Robbie Fowler's head or Stanley Colin Howard's head or whatever. There was a huge connection there. And, you know, yeah, I look back on some of the like the key assists, if you want to call them, back on your career. You know, you set up Michael Owen's first goal for the club at Wimbledon. Yeah. You even assisted Jamie Carragher for a goal, which doesn't really happen very often. And of course, there's the crazy, crazy 4-3 game against Newcastle, and your cross for Robbie Fowler took away the winners. You know, how did it feel like to have, you know, such quality attacking players, and the way you were able to get chemistry on the pitch and be involved so much in special times, particularly that 4-3 must have been a crazy game to play in.
Yeah, it was unbelievable because we obviously had 4-3 the year before as well.
Absolutely.
So I think we won 4-3 2 years in a row against Newcastle at Anfield. So that was very special. Yeah, these are occasions, these are moments that that you not so much remember, but you always get reminded of them. It has meant a lot to the supporters, and I still, at an age of 49, get mentions from people that I meet that these occasions have meant something and stuck to their mind. And but the crossing and the ability with the left foot was something that I could bring into the team, and that was probably why I played the games I did, because of that. And I think if you look at the teams nowadays at that kind of level, they all the players have something special one way or the other that will fit into all the other qualities in the team. And this is how you put the team together. You can never have 11 similar players, you would lose every game with 11 Messis. It sounds strange, but you would probably have problems defending and with a few other things. Obviously, it would be exciting to watch a team like that going forward and attack, but you need to compose a team with different qualities that fit together, and one quality will strengthen the other quality. So I think that basically that's how it works. And in that team in 96-97, we really should have won the league. Unfortunately, we were too inconsistent. But quality-wise, at our best, we played the best football. And we did that over quite a long time. Obviously, we dropped quality a little bit towards the end, unfortunately. So we didn't manage to win. But that was a very exciting team to play in.
Yeah, just touching on that title campaign, like, it's very much, we look at the current Liverpool team fighting for the title. Your team was, I suppose you would best describe, very much in transition, the way the club was on and off the pitch. And through your time there, you know, you did win the League Cup in 95. But that title charge, how did it feel to be involved, like for your boyhood club, to be involved in that title charge? How does it feel? And I know we had the disappointment at the end where it kind of weathered away and we finished fourth. But just to be involved in it, just how special of a feeling was that?
Yeah, you can't really compare it to the boyhood dream. And that's where the realism comes in, because I wasn't at Liverpool for 8.5 years thinking every morning I woke up, this is my boyhood dream. It doesn't work like that. And it sounds a little strange, maybe, because you become more a realist. You become very focused. You're dependent on being very professional and focus in the right way. And you kind of need to hide away everything that will disturb your next performance, whether it's training or a match. You have to take away all the external disturbance, all the noise, all the attention you're getting, everyone who wants to be near you and talk to you. So it is demanding in that way, because obviously coming from Norway, with such a great support that Liverpool has in Norway, I had so many people who wanted to come over and visit and stay with me outside the training field, and that was a little bit of a challenge to find the right balance to make sure that I actually could go into work every day with the right focus and with the right energy. And I think I probably managed to do that quite well.
Yeah, and how did you find the transition, say, from when you arrive in 92? Because obviously, again, Liverpool were not at their best. I suppose they were nowhere near their peak at that point. And the first game you played in was the 5-1 loss to Coventry. Obviously, the team builds from there. But how did you find the transition?
I was a bit surprised when I first came over, because I saw the state that the club was in. It wasn't great. We were under pressure. The manager was obviously under pressure as well, trying to build something new. He made some changes. Maybe, I think he's even admitted later on that he did make too many changes too quick. Again, this is a balance, and I think he had the right intentions, because there was a generation of players who won a great deal, and he felt that he needed to change to get a younger generation through. And I have to say that it wasn't necessarily the right focus at all times from the young players who were lucky to get the chances that they did, and this is also to do with culture. You have to build a strong culture with very strong demands on what's needed to be successful. If you give young players too much too early, it can be complacent and not keeping the right focus every day. And that, to be fair, that did happen with some of the players, but some other players picked up the learning and really had a fantastic career, like Robbie Fowler, Jamie Carragher, Steven Gerrard, Michael Owen. It was Jamie Redknapp. It was fantastic to see how they took that learning, did some mistakes to start with, picked it up, learned how to focus right, and the rest was history for quite a few of them.
Yeah, and you spoke there about that idea of not having too much too soon, and also an idea of a culture that spread into the community as well. And I think it's one of the reasons why people in Liverpool are really fond of you as well, because of course around the time, around 1995, the Dockers strike has just happened, and it's essentially a protest against the backdoor introduction of casual labour. And you know, obviously the local lads like McManaman and Fowler had taken an interest, that even worn t-shirts that were in support of it. Yeah. Interestingly, you went down to have a look and show a bit of solidarity, and one of the things I was reading was one person who was involved in the protests pointed out that the way you dealt with it was you were speaking to everybody, you weren't there to, it wasn't a photo opportunity or anything for that, in comparison to maybe other people, other celebrities that would have popped down to see what was going on. What led you to go down and take a look for yourself?
Well, it was respect, curiosity, and support. I learned about the situation through the media, through the local media, through also through the engagement that some of the players had. I would say, luckily, I've always had, it's always been necessary for me to take an interest in other things than football, to be able to play football. I couldn't concentrate on football 100% all the time, all my spare time, and only do that. That would have been impossible. I needed other sources to get some perspectives on things, and the political situation in Liverpool's history, and also the current history, the current situation at the time with the Dockers was something that I took an interest in, and I couldn't dream of coming down there with some cameramen and some journalists around me. I went down there one afternoon after training, just by myself. I didn't have a faintest idea how the welcome would be from them. So I parked my car and went across to them and chatted to them, and I had some questions. I presented myself, of course, and I think I spent a good hour with them, and it was a very memorable thing for me to experience, because I learned about their frustration, why they were there, and why they were fighting so hard, and how they made their stance, and it was a strong experience, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, and that community engagement idea, it's fed into the work you're doing now as sporting director with Rosenborg. So as part of what you're doing in terms of developing the players, it seems you're also influencing them as well to take an interest in other things that are going on outside of football, like what's going on in the community, charity work, etc.
Yeah, it's a big thing. The club has a set of values. We want to come across as a value-based football club that takes an interest in society, especially the local society. We have a strong tradition as a football team, but I think the popularity of Rosenborg is very much down to the engagement in the society, because it creates support, and it Rosenborg is an institution in the area for generations, and it's important that we continue to do that. That we go to school visits. We do anti-bullying campaigns in school, and we engage also the players to go and do speaks, talks, lecturing in schools. So we know we can make a difference if we do it right. If the interest is natural and real, and not just for propaganda, it needs to be. Most of the times, it's without journalists, without media. It's kind of underground activities to show a genuine interest in what's going on in the local society.
Yeah, and I suppose on the pitch, Gerard Houllier eventually came in 1997, and of course there was a period as well, a crossover period with Roy Evans. What did you make of that situation, I suppose, with co-managers, because it's not that common in football?
Yeah, it was a surprise when it happened. We heard Julio's name had been mentioned previously. He he obviously had a strong position at the club, and he had a link to the club. But when the announcement was made, I remember where I was and when it was, and I was a little bit surprised, and I was very curious to see what I was coming back to after that summer break. I had at the time also just signed a new long-term contract, so yeah, this is something that you that it means a lot what kind of leadership and what kind of position you have in the squad with the new coach. I think Julier had some great ideas to change around a few things to make it even more professional. He had a set of demands again that was quite tough for a lot of the players, and they also brought in quite a big number of new players to start with, and again maybe too many too quick. So it was a lot of changes at the time.
Yeah, what your own personal, I suppose, Liverpool career kind of tailed off along with Gerard Houllier taking full ownership of the team. Is that something that frustrates you, the way your time at Liverpool kind of came to an end? I know you went on to rejoin your Graeme Souness, who had signed you at Blackburn, but was there frustrations from your point the way your ending at Liverpool finished off?
Not really, not really. I think at the time and also now, thinking back, these things happen. I mean, new managers come in, new ideas. They want to change things around. They want to bring in new players. I had been there a very long time. I was grateful. I wasn't frustrated. I was grateful for the time I had there, and I had to accept that a new manager came in with some new ideas. And I didn't leave Liverpool on bad terms with Julier or anybody. I also spoke to Gerard Houllier a couple of times after, and we have a respectful relationship. That's no problem.
And one of the players that kind of, I suppose, ultimately went on to replace you on the team was Dominic Mateo. Actually, through my good friend John Bradley at LFC TV, I got a text from Dominic there, just trying to do to some digging on, see could we get any insight or any, was there any stories from the training ground already? And I'll just read back the text that I got back. It was like, just a nice bloke, mate. Family man, like the crack, but nothing mental. Solid player, great professional, but as for the stories, nothing to tell. I was getting a bit kind of, oh no, this is going to be an absolute killer. But the last line put a bit of hope in my heart. It said, ask him about the Christmas parties. He was always good for a laugh, especially fancy dress. So I'm all ears now to hear what sort of costume you pulled off of those, because I've heard all the stories about those Liverpool Christmas parties. There's loads of stories at the time. You know, of course, this is ultimately the Spice Boy hero, isn't it? Any good stories that you're going to give us a giggle here?
Well, his memory is probably better than mine, to be completely honest, because I'm not entirely sure what he's pointing out there. But I found the whole Christmas party thing very, very scary. So
I think that's normal. I think even our Christmas parties sometimes you have a bit of a worry. one thing, actually, as Jonathan mentioned, you moved on to Blackburn. Obviously, played under Souness again. You were playing behind somebody we know very well, who we've had on the show before, Damien Duff. Can you just tell us what a young Damien Duff was like to play behind?
Fantastic, unbelievable talent. I was very impressed with him. Very, very nice. Very nice guy as well. Humbled, worked hard, and he had some fantastic ability as a player. It was a complete joy to play with. And I also remember leaving the club, how it was to say goodbye to Damien. We had a chat about all the games that we played together, and how we played together, and how joyful it was at times. And I also hear that it's going really well with him now, doing his coaching. So
he's over at Celtic now. He's part of the Neil Lennon's team. Yeah,
yeah, that's fantastic to hear. I just learned that a couple of days ago, and I'm really happy for him. And it's nice to hear that he's now making a career, staying in football and doing well.
Yeah, and interestingly, obviously, he won the 2002 League Cup final, beating Spurs in the final with Blackburn. But one of your teammates, of course, was Henning Berg. And what it made me think of was, of course, the generation of Norwegian players that arrived in the 1990s. So yourself, Tore Andre Flo, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, obviously Berg as well, Ronnie Janssen, I could go on, Rekdal as well. An amazing, I suppose the word golden generation gets thrown around, but this was a golden generation. And obviously Egil Olsen as the manager who was overseeing all of this. When you first broke into the team and when that team started to come together, did you feel you were going to go far?
I made my debut really young playing for Norway. I think I was 19, and it was a couple of years before Egil Olsen started to build his team that you just mentioned. So I had some experience with playing for Norway, and those were not necessarily good ones, although I really enjoyed to play for them as a young player. But at the time, it didn't look like we were going anywhere. But when Egil came in with his ideas, he turned around the heads of the most experienced players, got them to understand exactly how he wanted to play, and also the genius thing that Egil did was to get us to understand that we can't play like Barcelona. We need to play to our strengths, and our strengths as players were nothing near the strengths of the teams that we basically started beating.
Yeah, and one of the
we built up an unbelievable belief in what we were doing together as a team, and that was the secret.
Yeah, and of course there are two victories against Brazil, but before that, of course, he went to the 1994 World Cup, which was the first tournament he'd played in as a country since 1934. So it was a great moment. It was kind of around the same time Ireland were having a really good time as well. But of course, he played Ireland in 1994, the final game of that group, 0-0 draw. Yeah. A lot of people who would be later teammates or already teammates as well. What's your memory of that game in particular? Because it was one where you needed the goal.
I only got one memory from the game, and it was really dull.
we're interested. We're all ears anyway.
No. The dullness of the game was.
Oh right, it was. It was a poor game.
No, yeah, it was poor. It was really dull. None of the teams seemed to be able to create the chances they needed to win. Again, I don't know the details, but I do remember it was a terrible game. Must have been a terrible game to watch.
No, it was great for us.
Oh, it was wonderful for us because we got to go on and go and lose the last 16 game to the Dutch. But we'll forget about that. Of course, there are people in that team, as I said. Jason McAteer, who we've had on the show a couple of times as well, a real character. Who else? Obviously, there's Phil Babb, a few others. In terms of those ones, you would have got to know them later on. Who were you most fond of the Irish lads in the Liverpool team?
I couldn't separate them. I was lucky to get on well with most of the players and Babsy and McAteer as well. Good friends, great guys, good laugh. I enjoyed really much playing in that team mentioned before, 96-97, with both Phil Babb and Jason as my colleague on the other side, running up and down, doing all the hard work. We had luxury players in the middle like John Barnes, so Jason and me had to do all the running.
Yeah,
which we did, and I think we connected really well because we understood each other's role, obviously having the same role on each side, and we also seemed to understand how much running was involved both ways.
Yeah,
because we seemed to take the responsibility to defend and also the responsibility to get there and put the crosses in. So I ran past John Barnes coming forward and I ran past him coming back defending.
And of course, I mentioned Norway beating Brazil twice. So there was the 4-2 game in 1997, which was a friendly. But the most important one, of course, is the year later. I remember watching that game, although I think it was the same time Morocco were playing Scotland in the other games. I think the TV channel I had was with that game, but I did, you know, flick over and I saw obviously Rekdal scoring the penalty as you beat. And I think, did he say he dreamed about that moment like the night before or something? So it was like a premonition.
I can't remember that, but it was under pressure. I think Brazil, to be fair, they were already through. And the game itself is a has become a legend in Norwegian sports history. Saying that, the game wasn't spectacular, but it was good. I think our performance was pretty good. We came down 1-0, and we obviously leveled the game, and then we had the penalty towards the end, and won it. So that was very special. It's not very often that the Norwegian team is playing in the World Cup, and obviously beating Brazil, who are the legends of international football, makes it very, very special, at least for the supporters and all the followers of Norwegian sports.
Absolutely. And Stig, just to diverge ever so slightly, I've heard you speak so passionately on your passion for coaching and passing on skills to other young kids, and passing on skills that you've picked up throughout your career. You've been lucky enough to play under a lot of good managers. Which manager or what style of football or what coach kind of had the most impact on you that you try now pass on in your current role?
I'm lucky to have played with so many great coaches and at different periods of my career. I seem to have the right coaches. When I was a kid, I had the right coaches. When I first became a professional, I had the right coach. And when I obviously came to Rosenborg, I had the legendary Nils Arne Eggen, who could have picked and chosen. He took Rosenborg to Champions League group stage 11 times.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable. And his coaching style was phenomenal. He could have coached any international club at the time, because his attacking ideas was based on togetherness, relations, and movements without the ball in front of the guy with the possession. So that was very exciting to be part of, to understand the game that we did together with Nils Arne Eggen at Rosenborg, and then Sunes, who signed me, that's special. Roy Evans, who believed in me so much, that's really special. So I've been lucky, and it's different reasons for why I think they've been good for my career. Different reasons, very, very different coaches, but for me, it's worked out well.
Yeah, and I suppose a lot of people are also, obviously you're sporting director now with Rosenborg, but people are always curious what that role really entails. In terms of the relationship between a manager and a sporting director, how does it work?
Very good. I couldn't be a good sporting director unless I was working closely with the head coach. So that relationship is very, very important. It's vulnerable with the sporting director and the head coach if they don't get on well together, because it's two kind of leader positions who more or less making decisions within the same area. So it's really, really down to creating a good working relationship with a common understanding and what direction you want to go. And you also need to separate clearly who's doing what. I'm obviously not involved in the coaching, in the technical side of it, in the team picking and the game preparations. I'm more involved in the overall administration of the first team, building the culture, putting together the squad with the right personnel, and I also do all the buying and selling negotiations and all that.
But we
work well together, and also together with the CEO. So we have there's a threesome there that are really dependent on understanding each other well and respecting each other and work together well.
Yeah, and I suppose a final question, actually, just before we let you go, but your former Norway teammate, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, of course, has gone into management now, in charge of Manchester United, doing an absolutely brilliant job. Were you surprised when United made the move to bring him in, and what have you made of his success so far?
Yeah, surprised, yes and no. It's a tough move from Man United, but at the same time, I think what happened there was some consultancy with Sir Alex, who must have suggested that Man United should come back to the roots. And I think Ole Gunnar is one for the roots. He's one who understands the club, who respects the club for its history, and also he's had a fantastic spell there, and together with Sir Alex Ferguson. And I think he's also been very closely in touch with the club since he left, and also with Sir Alex since he left. So I think his position was quite strong. And I think what Ole has done is taken Man United back to the supporters. And that's a clever move. He's looking like he's getting the job now, as far as I can see. So good luck to him.
Yeah, and he certainly deserves the job based on results anyway. But Stig, it's been fascinating chatting to you about your career as a player and also what you're doing now. And I suppose looking back at some great moments, particularly that Norway generation, as I said, just a fascinating one. It's always good to see a good generation of players, especially in a smaller country in terms of population, coming together and being able to play at the highest stage. So thanks a million for your time, and best of luck with your current role.
Absolutely, Stig.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
All right, that is Stig Inge Bjørneby, former Norway international, but for us, probably well known for his Liverpool career. So, Jonathan, as I kind of gauged while we were doing this interview, you have a lot of first-hand memories of his career.
Yeah, it's felt a bit surreal, and the same with Marco Babbel recently as well. It's a bit surreal, you know, players that you idolise as kids, getting the opportunity to chat to them. And yeah, it was a very interesting guy, very level-headed guy. Some really good stories there as well. Through his time on and off the pitch.
Have we ever had somebody you've idolised on the show, Joe, that you've been starstruck by? I'm trying to think.
No,
back in the early days.
No, not really. I don't think so, Raph. The only, actually, like, between all my time when I was working full-time in Newstalk, and now, and whatever, that's since 2011, the only time you're going to laugh at this, the only time I ever recall going, God, I'd love to get a photograph, because I never got a photograph. Never bothered with photographs for anyone that came in. But the only time I went, I'd love to get a photograph, was when Kieran MacDonald came in.
I was about to say, it has to be him. Hold on.
It had to be Kieran MacDonald. And it's literally the only time I was like, oh my God, it's Kieran MacDonald.
I owe Johnny money now because of what you just said. You know, we had a bet on it. Just
so you did. But I know that you're probably going, oh my God. But I know. No, if we had to, there'd be certain Arsenal players I'd be very interested.
Yeah, no, you weren't there for the Ian Wright one. Yeah. That probably would be
that would have been, if I was there, would have been a massive highlight, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't think of too many for myself.
Well, to be honest with you...
No great Leitrim footballers, no.
And then, yeah,
I was trying to Emlyn Mulligan out on the couch here when he was in doing the Gaelic football show on Off the Ball, but
there is an element,
I didn't ask for a photo.
There is, like, some give more than others, but like, there's nothing worse than, you know, and we've done a couple of them where you're doing the interview and after about two questions, you're like, oh my God, this is crap. Because they're just giving you really rubbish clichés.
We won't name names. Anyway, it's quite rare, actually, as well.
It's very rare, but yeah. Like, it does happen. I mean, and the listener knows it happens. I think anyone listening to radio will know when somebody's actually speaking and when someone's just giving you the usual nonsense that you're just going, I'm not actually learning anything from this. And it's not that the person sitting on the opposite chair is going, this is great stuff. They're just going, God, it's really hard to get them to say anything. Some are better than others at giving stuff, you know. Yeah. But it is a bit of a game as well. Like, some athletes obviously want to come on to whatever, if they're selling something, to sell it, but they want to try and do it without actually giving you anything. So you're getting robbed in a way. That's just my take on it.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
I wasn't turned you to say anything.
You might as well finish up with a Ruby comment.
Well, I'm often tongue-tied around Derek Ryan, to be honest. But
TV's Derek Ryan.
He's not here today, so I'm more relaxed.
We will put his comment, or your comments, directly to him in the WhatsApp group, and then you can deal with it in there. I might just turn the notifications off for a while. But I think that sums us up anyway for this week. Conor Neville, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You might as well fish out that 2016 article that you can't remember writing. That
I have
Joe's
it here
reading
on the laptop.
Jonathan Higgins, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you very much.
And good stuff on the Stig interview. And Joe Coffey.
Raph, a pleasure as always.
Good stuff. Take it away, Johan. We'll be right back.